This is Audible.
Blackstone Publishing presents The Enigma of Arrival, a novel, by V.S. Naipaul. This book is read by Simon Vance. In loving memory of my brother, Shiva Naipaul, 25th February 1945, Port of Spain, 13th August 1985, London. Jack's Garden. For the first 4 days it rained. I could hardly see where I was. Then it stopped raining, and beyond the lawn and outbuildings in front of my cottage I saw fields with stripped trees on the boundaries of each field, and far away, depending on the light, glints of a little river, glints which sometimes appeared oddly to be above the level of the land. The river was called the Avon, not the one connected with Shakespeare. Later, when the land had more meaning, when it had absorbed more of my life than the tropical street where I had grown up, I was able to think of the flat, wet fields with the ditches as water meadows, or wet meadows, and the low, smooth hills in the background, beyond the river, as downs. But just then, after the rain, all that I saw, though I had been living in England for 20 years, were flat fields and a narrow river. It was winter. This idea of winter and snow had always excited me. But in England the word had lost some of its romance for me, because the winters I had found in England had seldom been as extreme as I had imagined they would be when I was far away in my tropical island. I had experienced severe weather in other places. In Spain, in January, in a skiing resort near Madrid. In India, in Simla, in December. And in the high Himalayas, in August. But in England, this kind of weather hardly seemed to come. In England, I wore the same kind of clothes all through the year, seldom wore a pullover, hardly needed an overcoat. And though I knew that summers were sunny, and that in winter the trees went bare and brush-like, as in the watercolours of Roland Hilda, the year, so far as vegetation and even temperature went, was a blur to me. It was hard for me to distinguish one section or season from the other. I didn't associate flowers or the foliage of trees with any particular month. And yet I liked to look. I noticed everything, and could be moved by the beauty of trees and flowers and early sunny mornings and late light evenings. Winter was to me a time mainly of short days and of electric lights everywhere at working hours, also a time when snow was a possibility. If I say it was winter when I arrived at that house in the river valley, it is because I remember the mist, the 4 days of rain and mist that hid my surroundings from me and answered my anxiety at the time, anxiety about my work and this move to a new place, yet another of the many moves I had made in England. It was winter, too, because I was worried about the cost of heating. In the cottage there was only electricity, more expensive than gas or oil, and the cottage was hard to heat. It was long and narrow. It was not far from the water meadows and the river, and the concrete floor was just a foot or so above the ground. And then one afternoon it began to snow. Snow dusted the lawn in front of my cottage, dusted the bare branches of the trees, outlined disregarded things, outlined the empty, old-looking buildings around the lawn that I hadn't yet paid attention to or fully taken in, so that piece by piece, while I considered the falling snow, a rough picture of my setting built up around me. Rabbits came out to play on the snow, or to feed, a mother rabbit hunched with 3 or 4 of her young. They were a different, dirty colour on the snow, and this picture of the rabbits, or more particularly their new colour, calls up, or creates the other details of the winter's day. The late afternoon snow light, the strange empty houses around the lawn becoming white and distinct and more important. It also calls up the memory of the forest I thought I saw behind the whitening hedge against which the rabbits fed. The white lawn, the empty houses around it, the hedge to one side of the lawn, the gap in the hedge, a path, the forest beyond. I saw a forest. But it wasn't a forest, really. It was only the old orchard at the back of the big house in whose grounds my cottage was. I saw what I saw very clearly, but I didn't know what I was looking at. I had nothing to fit it into. I was still in a kind of limbo. There were certain things I knew, though. I knew the name of the town I had come to by the train. It was Salisbury. It was almost the first English town I had got to know, the first I had been given some idea of, from the reproduction of the Constable painting of Salisbury Cathedral in my third standard reader, far away in my tropical island before I was 10. A four-colour reproduction, which I had thought the most beautiful picture I had ever seen. I knew that the house I had come to was in one of the river valleys near Salisbury. Apart from the romance of the Constable reproduction, the knowledge I brought to my setting was linguistic. I knew that Avon originally meant only river, just as hound originally just meant a dog, any kind of dog. And I knew that both elements of Waldenshaw, the name of the village and the manor in whose grounds I was, I knew that both Walden and Shaw meant wood. One further reason why, apart from the fairy-tale feel of the snow and the rabbits, I thought I saw a forest. I also knew that the house was near Stonehenge. I knew there was a walk which took one near the stone circle. I knew that somewhere high up on this walk there was a viewing point. And when the rain stopped and the mist lifted, after those first 4 days, I went out one afternoon looking for the walk and the view. There was no village to speak of. I was glad of that. I would have been nervous to meet people. After all my time in England, I still had that nervousness in a new place, that rawness of response. Still felt myself to be in the other man's country. Felt my strangeness, my solitude. And every excursion into a new part of the country, what for others might have been an adventure, was for me like tearing at an old scab. The narrow public road ran beside the dark, yew-screened grounds of the manor. Just beyond the road and the wire fence and the roadside scrub, the down sloped sharply upwards. Stonehenge and the walk lay in that direction. There would have been a lane or path leading off the public road. To find that lane or path, was I to turn left or right? There was no problem, really. You came to a lane if you turned left, you came to another lane if you turned right. Those two lanes met at Jack's cottage, or the old farmyard where Jack's cottage was, in the valley over the hill. Two ways to the cottage. Different ways. One was very old and one was new. The old way was longer, flatter. It followed an old, wide, winding riverbed. It would have been used by carts in the old days. The new way, meant for machines, was steeper, up the hill and then directly down again. You came to the old way if you turned left on the public road. This stretch of road was overhung by beaches. It ran on a ledge in the down just above the river, and then it dropped almost to the level of the river. A little settlement here, just a few houses. I noticed a small old house of brick and flint, with a fine portico, and, on the river bank, very close to the water, a low, white-walled thatched cottage that was being done up. Years later that cottage was still being done up. Half-used sacks of cement were still to be seen through the dusty windows. Here, in this settlement, you turned off into the old way to Jack's cottage. An asphalt lane led past half a dozen ordinary little houses, two or three of which carried, their only fanciful touch, the elaborate monogram of the owner, or builder, or designer, with the date, which was, surprisingly, a date from the war, 1944. The asphalt gave out, the narrow lane became rocky, then, entering a valley, became wide, with many flinty, wheeled ruts separated by uneven strips of coarse, tufted grass. This valley felt old. To the left, the steep slope shut out a further view. This slope was bare, without trees or scrub. Below its smooth, thin covering of grass could be seen lines and stripes, like wheels, suggesting many consecutive years of tilling a long time ago. Suggesting also fortifications. The wide way twisted, the wide valley, possibly an ancient river course, which the way occupied, then ran straight and far, bounded in the distance by the beginning of a low down. Jack's cottage and the farmyard were at the end of that straight way, where the way turned. The other way to the cottage, the shorter, steeper, newer way up from the main road and then down to the valley and the farmyard, was lined on the northern side with a windbreak, young beech trees protected by taller pines. At the top of the slope there was a modern, metal-walled barn. Just a little way down on the other side there was a gap in the windbreak. This was the viewing point for Stonehenge. Far away, small, not easy to see. Not as easy as the luminous red or orange targets of the army firing ranges. And at the bottom of the slope, down the rocky, uneven lane beside the windbreak, were the derelict farm buildings, and the still living row of agricultural cottages, one of which Jack lived in. The downs all around were flinty and dry, whitish-brown, whitish-green. But on the wide way at the bottom, around the farm buildings, the ground was muddy and black. The tractor wheels had dug out irregular linear ponds in the black mud. The first afternoon, when I reached the farm buildings, walking down the steep way beside the windbreak, I had to ask the way to Stonehenge. From the viewing point at the top it had seemed clear, but from that point down had risen against down, slope against slope, dips and paths had been hidden, and at the bottom, where mud and long puddles made walking difficult and made the spaces seem bigger, and there appeared to be many paths, some leading off the wide valley way, I was confused. Such a simple inquiry, though, in the emptiness. And I never forgot that on the first day I'd asked someone the way. Was it Jack? I didn't take the person in. I was more concerned with the strangeness of the walk, my own strangeness, and the absurdity of my inquiry. I was told to go round the farm buildings, to turn to the right, to stick to the wide main way, and to ignore all the tempting dry paths that led off the main way to the woods which lay on the other side, young woods that falsely suggested deep country, the beginning of forest. So, past the mud around the cottages and the farmyard, past the mess of old timber and tangled old barbed wire and apparently abandoned pieces of farm machinery, I turned right. The wide muddy way became grassy, long, wet grass. And soon, when I had left the farm buildings behind and felt myself walking in a wide, empty, old riverbed, the sense of space was overwhelming. The grassy way, the old riverbed, as I thought, sloped up, so that the eye was led to the middle sky, and on either side were the slopes of the downs, widening out and up against the sky. On one side there were cattle. On the other side, beyond a pasture, a wide, empty area, there were young pines, a little forest. The setting felt ancient. The impression was of space, unoccupied land, the beginning of things. There were no houses to be seen, only the wide grassy way, the sky above it, and the wide slopes on either side. It was possible on this stretch of the walk to hold on to the idea of emptiness, but when I got to the top of the grassy way and was on a level with the barrows and tumuli which dotted the high downs all around, and I looked down at Stonehenge, I saw also the firing ranges of Salisbury Plain, and the many little neat houses of West Amesbury. The emptiness, the spaciousness through which I had felt myself walking was as much an illusion as the idea of forest behind the young pines. All around, and not far away, were roads and highways, with brightly coloured trucks and cars like toys. Stonehenge, old barrows and tumuli outlined against the sky, the army firing ranges, West Amesbury. The old and the new, and from a midway or a different time, the farmyard with Jack's cottage at the bottom of the valley. Many of the farm buildings were no longer used. The barns and pens, red brick walls, roofs of slate or clay tiles, around the muddy yard were in decay, and only occasionally in the pens were there cattle, sick cattle, enfeebled calves, isolated from the herd. Fallen tiles, holed roofs, rusted corrugated iron, bent metal, a pervading damp, the colours rust and brown and black, with a glittering or dead green moss on the trampled, dung-softened mud of the pen yard. The isolation of the animals in that setting, like things themselves about to be discarded, was terrible. Once there were cattle there that had suffered from some malformation. The breeding of these cattle had become so mechanical that the malformation appeared mechanical too, the mistakes of an industrial process. Curious additional lumps of flesh had grown at various places on the animals, as though these animals had been cast in a mould divided into two sections, and as though, at the joining of the moulds, the cattle material, the mixture out of which the cattle were being cast, had leaked, and had hardened, matured into flesh, and had then developed hair with the black and white Frisian pattern of the rest of the cattle. There, in the ruined, abandoned, dungy, mossy farmyard, fresh now only with their own dung, they had stood, burdened in this puzzling way, with this extra cattle material hanging down their middles like a bull's dewlaps, like heavy curtains, waiting to be taken off to the slaughterhouse in the town. Away from the old farm buildings and down the wide flat way, which I thought of as the old road to the farm and Jack's cottage, there were other remnants and ruins, relics of other efforts or lives. At the end of the wide way, to one side of it in tall grass, were flat, shallow boxes, painted grey, set down in two rows. I was told later that they were, or had been, beehives. I was never told who it was who had kept the bees. Was it a farm worker, someone from the cottages, or was it someone more leisured, attempting a little business enterprise and then giving up and forgetting? Abandoned now, unexplained, the grey boxes that were worth no one's while to take away were a little mysterious in the unfenced openness. On the other side of the wide driveway, its great curve round the farm buildings just beginning here, in the shelter of young trees and scrub, there was an old green and yellow and red caravan in good condition, a brightly painted gypsy caravan of the old days, as I thought, looking as if its horses had been unhitched not long before. Another mystery, another carefully made thing abandoned, another piece of the past that no longer had a use but had not been thrown away. Like the antiquated, cumbersome pieces of farm machinery, scattered and rusting about the farm buildings. Midway down the straight, wide way, far beyond the beehives and the caravan, was an old hayrick, with bales of hay stacked into a cottage-shaped structure and covered with old black plastic sheeting. The hay had grown old. Out of its blackness there were green sprouts. The hay that had been carefully cut one summer and baled and stored was decaying, turning to manure. The hay of the farm was now stored in a modern open shed, a prefabricated structure which carried the printed name of the maker just below the apex of the roof. The shed had been erected just beyond the mess of the old farmyard, as though space would always be available and nothing old need ever be built over. The hay in this shed was new, with a sweet, warm smell, and the bales unstacked into golden, clean, warm-smelling steps, which made me think of the story about spinning straw into gold, and of references in books with European settings to men sleeping on straw in barns. But that had never been comprehensible to me in Trinidad, where grass was always freshly cut for cattle, always green and never browned into hay. Now, in winter, at the bottom of this damp valley, high-stacked golden hay bales, warm golden steps next to rutted black mud. Not far from the decaying rick, shaped like a hut or cottage, there were the remains of a true house, a house with walls that might have been of flint and concrete. A simple house, its walls perhaps without foundations, it was now quite exposed. Ruined walls, roofless, around bare earth. No sign of a stone or concrete floor. How damp it felt. All around the plot, the boundary trees, sycamore or beech or oak, had grown tall, dwarfing the house. Once they would have been barely noticeable, the trees that, living on while the house had ceased to be, now kept the ground chill and mossy and black and in perpetual shadow. Smaller houses beside the public roads, houses built by squatters in the last century, farm labourers, mainly, had established ownership rights for the builders and their descendants. But here, beside the grassy driveway, in the middle of downs and fields and solitude, the owner or the builder of the house had left nothing behind. Nothing had been established. Only the trees he had planted had continued to grow. Perhaps the house had been no more than a shepherd's shelter. But that was only a guess. Shepherd's huts would have been smaller. And the trees around the plot didn't speak of a shepherd's hut, didn't speak of a man lodging there for only a few nights at a time. Sheep were no longer the main animals of the plain. I saw sheep shearing only once. It was done by a big man, an Australian, I was told, and the shearing was done in one of the old buildings, timber walls and a slate roof, at the side of the cottage row in which Jack lived. I saw the shearing by accident. I had heard nothing about it. It just happened at the time of my afternoon walk. but the shearing had clearly been news for some. The farm people, and people from elsewhere as well, had gathered to watch. A display of strength and speed, the fleecy animal lifted and shorn, and sometimes cut, at the same time, and then sent off, oddly naked. The ceremony was like something out of an old novel, perhaps by Hardy, or out of a Victorian country diary. And it was as though, then, the firing ranges of Salisbury Plain, and the vapour trails of military aircraft in the sky, and the army houses and the roaring highways didn't lie around us. As though, in that little spot around the farm buildings and Jack's cottage, time had stood still, and things were as they had been, for a little while. But the sheep shearing was from the past, like the old farm buildings, like the caravan that wasn't going to move again, like the barn where grain was no longer stored. This barn had a high window with a projecting metal bracket. Perhaps a pulley wheel and a chain or rope had been attached to this metal bracket to lift bales off the carts and wagons, and then swing them through the high, open window into the barn. There was a similar antique fixture in the town of Salisbury, at the upper level of what had been a well-known old grocery shop. It had survived, or been allowed to live on, as an antique, a trademark, something suited to an old town careful of its past. But what was an antique in the town was rubbish at the bottom of the hill. It was part of a barn that was crumbling winter by winter, the barn and the other dilapidated farm buildings no doubt allowed to survive because, in this protected area, planning regulations allowed new buildings to go up only where buildings existed. And just as the modern prefabricated shed had replaced the old rotting hayrick, so, but far away, not a simple addition to the old farm buildings, the true barn was now at the top of the hill, beside the windbreak. It had galvanized tin walls. It would have been rat-proof. There, machinery caused everything to go, and the powerful trucks, not nowadays the wagons that might have used the flat driveway to the old barn at the bottom of the valley, climbed up the rocky lane from the public road and pulled into the concrete yard of the barn, and the spout from the barn poured the dusty grain into the deep trays of the trucks. The straw was golden, warm. The grain was golden. But the dust that fell all around, on the concrete yard, the rocky lane, the pines and young beeches of the windbreak, the dust that fell after the grain had poured into the trays of the trucks, was grey. At the side of the metal-walled barn, and below a metal spout, there was a conical mound of dust that had been winnowed by some mechanical means from the bigger conical mounds of grain in the barn. This dust, the mound firm at the base, wonderfully soft at the top, was very fine and grey. Without a speck of gold. New, this barn, with all its mechanical contrivances. But just next to it, across an unpaved muddy lane, was another ruin, a wartime bunker, a mound planted over with sycamores, for concealment, and with a metal ventilator sticking out oddly now among the trunks of the grown trees. The sycamores would have been planted at least 25 years before, but they had been planted close together, and they still looked young. Jack lived among ruins, among superseded things. But that way of looking came to me later, has come to me with greater force now, with the writing. It wasn't the idea that came to me when I first went out walking. That idea of ruin and dereliction, of out-of-placeness, was something I felt about myself, attached to myself. A man from another hemisphere, another background, coming to rest in middle life in the cottage of a half-neglected estate, an estate full of reminders of its Edwardian past, with few connections with the present, an oddity among the estates and big houses of the valley, and I a further oddity in its grounds. I felt unanchored and strange. Everything I saw in those early days as I took my surroundings in, everything I saw on my daily walk, beside the windbreak or along the wide grassy way, made that feeling more acute. I felt that my presence in that old valley was part of something like an upheaval, a change in the course of the history of the country. Jack himself, however, I considered to be part of the view. I saw his life as genuine, rooted, fitting, man fitting the landscape. I saw him as a remnant of the past, the undoing of which my own presence portended. It did not occur to me when I first went walking and saw only the view, took what I saw as things of that walk, things that one might see in the countryside near Salisbury, immemorial, appropriate things. It did not occur to me that Jack was living in the middle of junk, among the ruins of nearly a century, that the past around his cottage might not have been his past, that he might at some stage have been a newcomer to the valley, that his style of life might have been a matter of choice, a conscious act, that out of the little piece of earth which had come to him with his farm worker's cottage, one of a row of three, he had created a special land for himself, a garden where, though surrounded by ruins, reminders of vanished lives, he was more than content to live out his life, and where, as in a version of a book of hours, he celebrated the seasons. I saw him as a remnant. Not far away, among the ancient barrows and tumuli, were the firing ranges and army training grounds of Salisbury Plain. There was a story that because of the absence of people in those military areas, because of the purely military uses to which the land had been put for so long, and contrary to what one might expect after the explosions and mock warfare, there survived on the plain some kinds of butterflies that had vanished in more populated parts. And I thought that in some such fashion, in the wide droveway at the bottom of the valley, accidentally preserved from people, traffic and the military, Jack, like the butterflies, had survived. I saw things slowly. They emerged slowly. It was not Jack whom I first noticed on my walks. It was Jack's father-in-law. And it was the father-in-law rather than Jack who seemed a figure of literature in that ancient landscape. He seemed a Wordsworthian figure. Bent, exaggeratedly bent, going gravely about his peasant tasks as if in an immense Lake District solitude. He walked very slowly, the bent old man. He did everything very deliberately. He had worked out his own paths across the downs, and he stuck to them. You could follow these paths even across barbed wire fences by the blue plastic sacks, originally containing fertilizer, which the old man had rolled around the barbed wire and then tied very tightly with red nylon string, working with a thoroughness that matched his pace and deliberateness to create these safe, padded places where he could cross below the barbed wire or climb over it. The old man first, then. And after him, the garden in the midst of superseded things. It was Jack's garden that made me notice Jack. The people in the other cottages I never got to know, couldn't recognize, never knew when they moved in or moved out, but it took some time to see the garden. So many weeks, so many walks between the whitish chalk and flint hills up to the level of the barrows to look down at Stonehenge. So many walks just looking for hares. It took some time before, with the beginning of my new awareness of the seasons, I noticed the garden. Until then it had simply been there, something on the walk, a marker, not to be specially noticed. And yet I loved landscape, trees, flowers, clouds, and was responsive to changes of light and temperature. I noticed his hedge, first of all. It was well clipped, tight in the middle, but ragged in places at ground level. I felt from the clipping that the gardener would have liked that hedge to be tight all over, to be as complete as a wall of brick or timber or some kind of man-fashioned material. The hedge marked the boundary between Jack's fruit and flower garden and the droveway, which was very wide here, bare ground around the cottages and the farm buildings, and nearly always soft or muddy. In winter, the long puddles reflected the sky between black, tractor-marked mud. For a few days in summer, that black mud dried out, turned hard and white and dusty. So for a few days in the summer, the hedge that ran the length of the garden that Jack possessed with his cottage was white with chalk dust for a foot or so above the ground. In winter it was spattered with mud, drying out white or grey. The hedge hid nothing. As you came down the hill with the windbreak, you could see it all. The old rust and black farm buildings in the background, the grey-plastered cottages in front of them, the ground or gardens in front of the cottages, the emptiness or no-man's land in front of the cottage grounds or gardens, and beside Jack's garden, Jack's hedge, a little wall of mud-spattered green, abrupt in the openness of the droveway, like a vestige, a memory of another kind of house and garden and street, a token of something more complete, more ideal. Technically, the gardens were at the front of the cottages. In fact, by long use, the back of the cottages had become the front, and the front gardens had really become back gardens. But Jack, with the same instinct that made him grow and carefully clip and also abruptly end that hedge beside the droveway, treated his garden like a front garden. A paved path with a border of some sort ran from his front door all the way down the middle of his garden. This should have led to a gate, a pavement, a street. There was a gate, but this gate, set in a wide-meshed, wire-netting fence, led only to a wire-fenced patch of earth which was forked over every year. It was here that Jack planted out his annuals. In front of this was the empty area, the no-man's land between Droveway and the beginning of the cultivated down. Jack's ducks and geese had their sheds in that area, which was messy with dung and feathers. Though they were not penned in, the ducks and geese never strayed far. They just walked back and forth across the Droveway. Hedge, garden, planting out bed for annuals, a plot for ducks and geese, and beyond that, beyond the ground reserved for the other two cottages, just where the land began to slope up to the farm's machine-cultivated fields, was the area where Jack grew his vegetables. Every piece of ground was separate. Jack didn't see his setting as a whole, but he saw its component parts very clearly, and everything he tended answered the special idea he had of that thing. The hedge was regularly clipped, the garden was beautiful and clean and full of changing colour, and the goose plot was dirty, with roughly built sheds and enamel basins and bowls and discarded earthenware sinks, like a medieval village in miniature. All the various pieces of the garden Jack had established around the old farm buildings. This was Jack's style, and it was this that suggested to me, falsely as I got to know soon enough, the remnant of an old peasantry, surviving here like the butterflies among the explosions of Salisbury Plain, surviving somehow industrial revolution, deserted villages, railways, and the establishing of the great agricultural estates in the valley. So much of this I saw with a literary eye, or with the aid of literature. A stranger here, with the nerves of the stranger, and yet with a knowledge of a language and the history of the language and the writing, I could find a special kind of past in what I saw, with a part of my mind I could admit fantasy. I heard on the radio one morning that in the days of the Roman Empire, geese could be walked to market all the way from the province of Gaul to Rome. After this, the high-headed, dung-dropping geese that strutted across the muddy, rutted way at the bottom of the valley, and could be quite aggressive at times, Jack's geese, developed a kind of historical life for me, something that went beyond the idea of medieval peasantry, old English country ways, and the drawings of geese in children's books. And when one year, longing for Shakespeare, longing to be put in touch with the early language, I returned to King Lear for the first time for more than 20 years, and read in Kent's railing speech, "Goose, if I had you upon Sarum Plain, I'd drive ye cackling home to Camelot." The words were quite clear to me. Sarum Plain, Salisbury Plain, Camelot, Winchester, just 20 miles away. And I felt that with the help of Jack's geese, creatures with perhaps an antiquity in the Droveway lands that Jack would not have guessed, I had arrived at an understanding of something in King Lear which, according to the editor of the text I read, commentators had found obscure. The solitude of the walk, the emptiness of that stretch of the downs, enabled me to surrender to my way of looking, to indulge my linguistic or historical fantasies, and enabled me at the same time to shed the nerves of being a stranger in England. Accident, the shape of the fields, perhaps, the alignment of paths and modern roads, the needs of the military, had isolated this little region, and I had this historical part of England to myself when I went walking. Daily I walked in the wide grassy way between the flint slopes, past chalk valleys rubbled white and looking sometimes like a Himalayan valley, strewn in midsummer with old gritted snow. Daily I saw the mounds that had been raised so many centuries before. The number of these mounds. They lay all around. From a certain height they were outlined against the sky and looked like pimples on the land. In the beginning I liked to tramp over the mounds that were more or less on my walk. The grass on these mounds was coarse. It was long-bladed, pale in colour, and grew in ankle-turning tufts or clumps. The trees where they existed were wind-beaten and stunted. I picked my way up and down and around each mound. I wanted in those early days to leave no accessible mound unlooked at, feeling that if I looked hard enough and long enough I might arrive not at an understanding of the religious mystery, but at an appreciation of the labour. Daily I walked in the wide, grassy way, perhaps in the old days a processional way. Daily I climbed up from the bottom of the valley to the crest of the way and the view, the stone circles directly ahead, down below, but still far away, grey against green, and sometimes lit up by the sun. Going up the grassy way, and though willing to admit that the true processional path might have been elsewhere, I never ceased to imagine myself a man of those bygone times, climbing up to have this confirmation that all was well with the world. There was a main road on either side of the henge. On those two roads, trucks and vans and cars were like toys. At the foot of the henge, there was the tourist crowd. Not very noticeable. Not as noticeable as one might imagine from the fairground atmosphere around the stones when you actually went to them. The tourist crowd from this distance was noticeable only because of the red dress or coat that some of the women wore. That colour red among the visitors to Stonehenge was something that I never failed to see. Always someone in red among the little figures. And in spite of that crowd, and the highways, and the artillery ranges, with their fluorescent or semi-luminous targets, my sense of antiquity, my feeling for the age of the earth and the oldness of man's possession of it, was always with me. A vast, sacred burial ground bounded by the sky. Of what activity those barrows and tumuli spoke, what numbers, what organization, what busyness in these now virtually empty downs. That sense of antiquity gave another scale to the activities around one. But at the same time, from this height and with that wide view, there was a feeling of continuity. So the idea of antiquity, at once diminishing and ennobling the current activities of men, as well as the ideas of literature, enveloped this world which, surrounded by highways and army barracks though it was, and with the very clouds in the sky sometimes seeded by the vapour trails of busy military airplanes, came to me as a lucky find of the solitude in which on many afternoons I found myself. Lark Hill was the name of the Army Artillery School. In my first or second year there was something like a fair or open day there when, in the presence of the families of the soldiers, guns were fired off. But the Lark Hill I looked for on my walk was the hill with ancient barrows where literally larks bred and behaved like the larks of poetry. And drowned in yonder living blue, the lark becomes a sightless song. It was true. The birds rose and rose in almost vertical flight. I suppose I had heard larks before, but these were the first larks I noticed, the first I watched and listened to. They were another lucky find of my solitude, another unexpected gift. And that became my mood. When I grew to see the wild roses and hawthorn on my walk, I didn't see the windbreak they grew beside as a sign of the big landowners who had left their mark on the solitude, had preserved it, had planted the woods in certain places. In imitation, it was said, of the positions of the Battle of Trafalgar. Or was it Waterloo? I didn't think of the landowners. My mood was purer. I thought of these single-petaled roses and sweet-smelling blossoms at the side of the road as wild and natural growths. One autumn day, the days shortening, filling me with thoughts of winter pleasures, fires and evening lights and books, one autumn day I felt something like a craving to read of winter in Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, a poem I had read more than 20 years before at Oxford as part of the Middle English course. The hips and the haws beside the windbreak, the red berries of this dead but warm time of year, made me want to read again about the winter journey in that old poem. And I read the poem on the bus back from Salisbury where I had gone to buy it. So in tune with the landscape had I become, in that solitude, for the first time in England. Of literature and antiquity and the landscape, Jack and his garden, and his geese and cottage, and his father-in-law, seemed emanations. It was his father-in-law I noticed first, and it was his father-in-law I met first. I met him quite early on, while I was still exploring, and before I had settled on a regular daily route. I walked or picked my way down little-used lateral lanes on the hillsides, lanes deep in mud, or overgrown with tall grass, or overhung with trees. I walked in those early days along lanes or paths I was never to walk along again, and it was on one of those exploratory walks on a lateral lane, linking the steep rocky road beside the windbreak with the wider, flatter way, it was on one of those little-used, half-hidden lanes that I met the father-in-law. He was fantastically, absurdly bent, as though his back had been created for the carrying of loads. A strange croaking came out of him when he spoke to me. It was amazing that, speaking like that, he should attempt speech with a stranger. But more amazing were his eyes, the eyes of this bent man. They were bright and alive and mischievous. In his cadaverous face of a curious colour, a grey colour, a swarthiness which made me think of gypsy origins, in his cadaverous face with a bristle, almost a down of white on cheek and chin, these eyes were a wonder and a reassurance, that in spite of the accident that had permanently damaged his spine, the personality of the man remained sound. He croaked.
"Dogs? Dogs?"
That was what the croaking sounded like. He stopped, raised his head like a turtle. He croaked. He raised the finger of authority. He seemed to say,
"Dogs? Dogs?"
And it needed only an echoing word from me, "Dogs," for him to subside, be again a bent old man minding his own business. His eyes dimmed, his head sank down.
"Dogs,"
he muttered, the word choking in his throat.
"Worry pheasants."
Beside the lane, and in the shelter of trees, were hedge-high cages with pheasants. It was new to me, to see that these apparently wild creatures were in fact reared a little like backyard chickens. As it was new to me to understand that the woods all around had been planted, and all the alternating roses and hawthorns beside the windbreak of beech and pine. In the hidden lane, a little impulse of authority, even bullying, with someone who was a stranger, and, in terms of gypsiness, 20 times as swarthy. But it was the briefest impulse in the old man, and perhaps it was also a social impulse, a wish to exchange words with someone new, a wish to add one more human being to the tally of human beings he had encountered. He subsided. The brightness in his eyes went out, and I never heard him speak again. Our paths never really crossed. I saw him occasionally in the distance. Once I saw him actually with a load of wood on his bent back. Wordsworthian, the subject of a poem Wordsworth might have called The Fuel Gatherer. He walked very slowly, yet in that slowness, that deliberation, there was conviction. He had set himself a task he certainly intended to finish. There was something animal-like about his routine. Like a rat, he seemed to have a run. Though, apart from looking after the pheasants, which might not have been true, it wasn't clear to me what he did on the land. The droveway, the way along the floor of the ancient river valley, was very wide. When I first went walking, it was unfenced. In my first year, or the second, the wide way was narrowed. A barbed wire fence was put up. It ran down the middle of the way, where the way was long and straight, and those sturdy green fence posts, the thicker ones, stoutly buttressed, and the taut lines of barbed wire made me feel, although the life of the valley was just beginning for me, that I was also in a way at the end of the thing I had come upon. How sad it was to lose that sense of width and space. It caused me pain. But already I had grown to live with the idea that things changed. Already I lived with the idea of decay. I'd always lived with this idea. It was like my curse, the idea which I had had even as a child in Trinidad, that I had come into a world past its peak. Already I lived with the idea of death, the idea impossible for a young person to possess, to hold in his heart that one's time on earth, one's life, was a short thing. These ideas of a world in decay, a world subject to constant change, and of the shortness of human life, made many things bearable. Later, even older encroachments were revealed on the droveway. Looking down at Stonehenge one summer, from the Hill of Larks, I saw, from the change of colour in the fields of growing corn beside the droveway, what must have been the ruts of old cart or coach wheels, because this way had been the old coach or wagon road from Stonehenge to Salisbury, a road that, because of mud, needed to be much wider than a paved road. Now some of the width of that old road had been incorporated, a long time ago, into fields, and was behind barbed wire fencing. This fencing in of a great ancient way, This claiming as private property an ancient wide riverbed, no doubt sacred to the ancient tribes, and at one end of the wide valley, beyond the beehives, the caravan, the old hayrick and the ruined house, with the big sycamores, at that end, below the thin grass on the western bank, there were the marks either of ancient furrows or fortifications. This emphasis on property should have made me think of the present, the great estates by which I was surrounded, the remnant of the estate on which I lived. I saw the farmer, or the farm manager, making his rounds in a Land Rover. I saw the modern grain barn at the top of the hill. I saw the windbreak up and down that hill, and saw that it had been recently planted, with the pines growing faster than the beeches they were intended to protect, and already creating something like a strip of woodland, with a true woodland litter of fallen branches and dead wood. I saw the hand of man, but didn't sufficiently take it in, preferring to see what I wanted, the great geography of the plain here with the downs and the old river valley, far from the course of the present smaller river. I saw the antiquity. I saw the debris of the old farmyard. In this way of seeing at that time what I wanted to see, I was a little like Jack's father-in-law, who ignored the new fence that cut at many places into segments of his run across the driveway. He ignored the new gates, they were few, and stuck to his run, creating stiles and steps and padded passing places over and through the barbed wire, working in his old way, rolling blue plastic sacks around the barbed wire, and then tying them with spiral after spiral of red blonde raffia or nylon. The odd zigzag of the old man's run was now revealed, as were its widest limits. From the pheasant cages on the muddy, shaded lane on the far side of the hill with the new barn, down that lane, across the driveway, and all the way up a scrub-bordered field to the old wood on the northern slope. On a field gate there, one day in my first summer, I saw a number of crows, spread-eagled and rotting, some recent, some less so, some already reduced to feathery husks. It was strange to link this fierce act with a bent old man, who moved so slowly. But when his mischievous eyes came to mind, his swarthy white gypsy skin, his strong, sly face, the act fitted. A whole life, a whole enduring personality was expressed in that run, and so strong were the reminders of the old man's presence, so much of his spirit appeared to hover over his run, over his stiles and steps, and those oddly placed rolled-up plastic sacks, even those he had rolled up and tied long ago and were shredding now, plastic without its shine, blue turning to white, so much did all of this speak of the old man moving slowly back and forth on his own errands that it was some time before it occurred to me that I had not seen him for a while. And then I understood that what I had been seeing for many weeks past, many months past, were his relics. He had died. There had been no one to record the fact publicly, to pass the news on, and long afterwards, on the fences growing older themselves, those plastic wraps or pads continued to bleach and shred away. Still with us, like the other debris at the bottom of the valley, the roofless walls of the ruined house, the antiquated farm machinery below the young silver birches, the other machinery and discarded timber and metal below the beech trees at the back of the old farm buildings, the metal bracket in the loading window of the superseded, crumbling barn. And it was a good while later that I got to know that the old man had lived and died in Jack's house, and that he was Jack's father-in-law. But before I got to know Jack, I got to know the farm manager. I suppose, because Jack lived in one of the agricultural cottages attached to the farm, that the farm manager was Jack's boss. I never thought of them in that relationship, though. I thought of them as separate people. The farm manager made his rounds in a Land Rover. He had a dog with him, sometimes on the seat beside him, sometimes looking out from the back. We met on the rocky lane that led up from the bottom of the valley, where the old farm buildings and cottages were, to the new barn at the top of the hill. This was the steepest climb of the walk, and I treated it as the exercise part. It came at the right point, near the end, and it was just long enough and taxing enough to make me feel the muscles of my legs and to set me breathing deeply. It was on this hill that the farm manager stopped one afternoon to speak a friendly word, humorously offering a lift, perhaps, for the last 50 yards. He was a middle-aged man with glasses. The lane was narrow. I had on more than one afternoon had to stand aside to let him pass. I had at first seen just the Land Rover, the vehicle. Then I had seen the man inside, had become familiar with his features and the contented rather than watchful look of the dog with him. I had assumed that he was the farmer, the owner or lessee of these well-kept acres, and I had accordingly given him a farmer's walk when he got out of the Land Rover at the barn and walked in to see how the grain was drying out, or whatever it was he was going to check. I had endowed him with a special kind of authority, a special attitude to the land around us. But then I discovered from the man himself that he was not the landowner, and I had to revise my way of looking at him. He was only the farm manager, an employee. His inspection drives covered part of my walk. The lane beside the windbreak led down to the public road. In the sunken ground across this road was the cow or dairy section of the farm. Behind the cow sheds were the water meadows and, in the distance, the willows and other trees on the river bank. At the side of the road, at the entrance to this farmyard, there was a wooden platform 3 or 4 feet high. On this platform, milk churns were placed for collection by the dairy van. After this, the public road went past a thatched, pink-walled cottage and some plainer houses of flint and brick. Then came the yews and beeches of the manor. This was where my walk ended, a wide entrance in the dark green gloom, and then the bright lawn in front of my cottage. This was the part of the public road which, when I had come out onto it after the first 4 days of rain, had set me a puzzle, whether to turn to the right or the left. Now, if the manager's Land Rover came from behind and passed me here, I knew where it was going. Past the yews along the beech-hung road high above the river, and then down to the little settlement at river level, where the white-walled thatched cottage was being done up, and where an asphalted lane, progressively more broken, led past a number of small houses, some with raised monograms, to the wide, unpaved droveway. My feeling for that wide, grassy way had grown. I saw it as the old bed of an ancient river, almost something from another geological age. I saw it as the way down which geese might have once been driven to Camelot Winchester from Salisbury Plain. I saw it as the old stagecoach road. But it was near there, the present encroaching all the time on something more than the past, encroaching on antiquity, sacred ground, that among the small houses I had not paid much attention to, in a small, neatly fenced plot, with a paved drive and a low, little bungalow and an extravagant, overplanted garden, full of tall flowers and dwarf conifers and tall ornamental clumps, it was there, on the paved drive, that I saw the Land Rover one day, and on other days. This, then, was where the manager lived, and where his inspection drives ended, a little bit of suburbia, at the very edge of antiquity. Yet I had taken the house for granted. In the gradual shaping of the land around me, the neat house had taken longer to come out at me, to be noticed. The antiquity, so much vaguer, so much a matter of conjecture, had made its impression more easily. I was ready for it. Almost immediately, starting on his farm round, the manager would have driven down the deeply rutted droveway past the almost bare bank welted with ancient furrows. His thoughts, no doubt, of woods and fields and crops and cattle, seeing different things from those I saw, he would have driven down the straight length of the droveway now bisected by the barbed wire fence he had himself put up, or caused to be put up, past the roofless stone house with the tall sycamores, the old hayrick shaped like a cottage and covered with black plastic sheeting, past the caravan in the shade of the scrub and trees on one side, and the two rows of hives, incorporated now into the barbed wire enclosure on the other side. Past the old farm buildings, with a new hay shed, though, and the cottages, one of which was Jack's, past Jack's garden and goose ground, up to the new metal-walled barn. This was the manager's run, almost circular. It was also Jack's, and it was partly mine. I had seen Jack at work in his vegetable allotment, the plot beyond the cottage front gardens, at the beginning of the slope towards the farm's cultivated fields. I had noticed the odd elegance of his trimmed, pointed beard, and though in his allotment his personality was at once clearer than the personality of the other farm workers, whose personalities were at least half expressed by their tractors or their tractors' tasks, steadily, swath by swath, altering the colour or texture of a vast field, Jack had at first been a figure in the landscape to me. No more. as no doubt I also was to him. A stranger, a walker, someone exercising an old public right-of-way in what was now private land. But after some time, after many weeks, when he felt perhaps that the effort wouldn't be wasted, he adopted me. And from a great distance, as soon as he saw me, he would boom out a greeting, which came over less as defined words than as a deliberate making of noise in the silence. I saw him more clearly when he worked in the garden at the front or back of his cottage, and most clearly of all when he worked in his wire-fenced bedding-out plot, turning over the soft, dark, much-sifted earth below the old hawthorn tree. That brought back very old memories to me, of Trinidad, of a small house my father had once built on a hill, and a garden he had tried to get started in a patch of cleared bush. Old memories of dark, wet, warm earth and green things growing, old instincts, old delights. And I had an immense feeling for Jack, for the strength and curious delicacy of his forking and sifting gesture, the harmony of hand and foot. I saw, too, as the months went by, his especial exaggerated style with clothes, bare-backed in summer at the first hint of sun, muffled up as soon as the season turned. I grew to see his clothes as emblematic of the particular season, like something from a modern book of hours. And then one day he, like the farm manager in his Land Rover, stopped in his car on the steep hill from the farm buildings up beside the windbreak to the barn. Jack and the other cottagers had motor cars. Without cars they would not have been able to live easily in those cottages. The cottages were too far from the public road and many miles from shops. I believe that the postman called only once a week. I had heard the car and stood aside. It was what you had to do on this narrow farm road. If you wished to hide, you could stand in the windbreak itself, among the beeches and pines in the shaded litter of fallen branches. It was from this stepping aside and watching them pass in their cars or tractors that I had got to know the farm workers. And they, after the solitude of their tractor cabs and the downs, were invariably ready for a wave and a smile. It was the limit of communication. There was really nothing to add to the wave, the smile, the human acknowledgement. So it now turned out with Jack, though this stopping in his own car, in his free time, was special. We looked at each other, examined each other, made noises rather than talked. I had always noticed his pointed beard. Seeing him from a distance, I had thought of this beard as part of a young man's dash. Seeing him digging, considering his height, the depth of his chest, the sturdiness of his legs, his upright, easy walk, I had thought of him as a young man. But I saw now that his beard was almost grey. He was in his late 40s, perhaps. His eyes were far away. It was his eyes, oddly obstreperous, oddly jumpy, that gave him away, that said he was, after all, a farm worker, that in another setting, in a more crowded or competitive place, he might have sunk. And the discovery was a little disconcerting, because, after I had got rid of the idea that he was a remnant of an old peasantry, I had found in that beard of his, and in his bearing, his upright, easy, elegant walk, the attributes of a man with a high idea of himself, a man who had, out of principle, turned away from other styles of life. We had had little to say, but a neighbourliness had been established between us, and it continued to be expressed in his shout from afar. His garden taught me about the seasons, and I got to know in a new way things I must have seen many times before. I saw the blossom come on his well-pruned apple trees, got to know the colour of the blossom, carried it in my mind, and was able therefore always to recall it, attached it to a particular time of year, saw the small fruit form, hang green, grow with the rest of the garden, and then turn colour. I saw the fertility that at first did not seem possible in this chalky, flinty soil which in the summer could show white. In England I was not a gardener, and had not taken much interest in the little front gardens I had seen, and saw even now from the bus into Salisbury. Looking at those gardens, I saw only colours, and was barely able visually to disentangle one plant from another. But afternoon by afternoon, I considered Jack's garden, noticing his labour, and looking to see what his labour brought forth. I saw with the eyes of pleasure, but knowledge came slowly to me. It was not like the almost instinctive knowledge that had come to me as a child of the plants and flowers of Trinidad. It was like learning a second language. If I knew then what I know now, I would be able to reconstruct the seasons of Jack's garden, or gardens, but I can remember only simple things like the bulbs of spring, the planting out of annuals like marigolds and petunias, the delphiniums and lupins of high summer, and flowers like the gladiolus, which, to my delight, flourished in both the climate of England and the tropical climate of Trinidad. There were also the roses trained about